The first reading this morning comes from a new and generally more accurate translation of the great Persian poet called Maulana, but whom we know usually as Rumi, Jalal ed-Din Muhammad Balkhi Rumi. Rumi is the most translated and popular poet in the United States of America right now.
My heart, spend time with those who understand you. Sit only under a tree that is full of blossoms. In the marketplace, don't wander about aimlessly. Find the shop with a potion that is sweet. If you don't have a way of measuring things, people will rob you in no time. You will take counterfeit coins, thinking they are real. Don't fill your bowl with food from every stew pot that you run across. Not every joke is funny. So don't go looking for meaning where and when there isn't any. Not every eye can see. Not every ocean is full of pearls. My heart, sing your song of longing as if you were a night bird in the forest. The sound of your voice casts spells on everything around you, stones, even thorns. So lay down, my heart. Let go of all distractions. Kiss the dawn inside you and let it guide you beyond the winds of desire. There, my heart, you will find a spring nourished by sweet waters like a tree of life. You will bear fruit forever.
The second reading comes from a book called Epiphany, which was edited by Elise Ballard, and which contains intriguing interviews with folks who talk about the changes in their lives following their attention to the promptings of their inner voice, their inner life. It just came out a few weeks ago. This reading is excerpted from an interview with a well-known motivational speaker named Ariane de Bonvoisin.
By age 29, I had worked at three very big media companies in senior positions. Not only did I have the perfect job, I had the perfect boyfriend, but I also had the perfect New York City lifestyle. To the world, I had it all. And I was miserable. By the time I hit 31, I started getting pretty unhealthy. I was 30 pounds heavier, and I was getting rashes all over my body. No doctor could tell me what was wrong. I had to check into a hospital. After some tests, I remember thinking, this is crazy. I mean, I'm a girl that runs marathons and stuff like that, and here I am in a hospital bed with drips in me. And then it dawned on me, I'm allergic to my life. The guy I'm dating, my job, my body. when I got home, I really got honest. I started journaling. What I realized was that this dream career was simply toxic for me. And so began my journey to unravel it all and to admit the truth to people. This seemingly perfect life was off course, and I was unhappy. I hit a lot of resistance from my family, my friends and colleagues, and even from myself. For the first time in my life, I had no idea what would come next. It took 2.5 years. During those years, I did nonprofit work and started listening to the voice I heard while sitting on my bed in the hospital. Basically, what I realized is that every single time something has not been right for me, I have known. I have always known. Every mistake I have ever made has been while I have ignored that voice. It's connected to something bigger than my own ego or to the person who wants to fit in with what's accepted. I came to the point where I always asked myself this question: how does this feel to my heart, to my body?
I don't think I've ever told anyone here this, but I used to dance a lot once upon a time. I was quite good at it back when I was young and when my ligaments were looser. I used to dance at clubs. I used to love to dance at weddings. And I was part of my university's Slavic dance ensemble, and we traveled all over the Midwest. The absolute pinnacle of my dance experience, however, was the night that I actually danced on the stage at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Yes, that Carnegie Hall. Golden and resplendent. A stage polished by the feet of famous dancers and singers on the international scene. I know this seems hard to believe, but it's true. I really did it. But of course, although I'm not lying, I am allowing you to run away with the story inappropriately. If you believe me at all, you may have imagined me dancing at best as part of a troupe. Or maybe you saw me dancing before a crowd, if not a full house, all 2,800 seats, then at least a few very loyal friends. But now here's the whole truth. I really did dance on the stage of Carnegie Hall, but not when anyone was watching. The only person there was my dear friend Kim. Kim and I spent time at Carnegie Hall backstage one weekend in the spring, some 12 years ago. Kim, you see, had written a poetic text for a gorgeous cantata by the composer Richard Danielpour called Elegies, which premiered on that hallowed stage. Friederike von Stadter and Thomas Hampson sang that night in the cantata, and it was absolutely beautiful. All of Kim's friends, all of us, flew to New York for the premiere. How could we not? And I got to be her date as we prepared for this event. But after the concert was over, as everyone else made their way to the Russian tea room next door to celebrate this successful debut, Kim stopped me in my tracks and whispered, "Look, Mark, the stage is empty. No one's in the building except us. Let's go on the stage and tell people that we danced at Carnegie Hall. How cool is that?" So, laughing all the way, we did a polka on the stage of Carnegie Hall. And then after a few moments, we left the stage, joining the rest of the cast over at the Russian Tea Room and getting on with our post-concert real lives. Now, I tell you this story to begin my reflections to sound a clear note of caution. The voice of truth, you see, can be pretty deceptive. It really depends on context, it depends on trust, and it depends on a full and honest disclosure. Now, I really was part of a Russian dance troupe, and I really did once love to dance at clubs, and I've always loved to polka wildly at the Polish weddings and Italian weddings up in Detroit, my hometown. And I really did polka on the stage of Carnegie Hall. But no one but Kim saw me, and really, it was no big deal. We were just having fun. But as Ariane de Bonvoisin made clear in the second reading, there are some events in life that really are a big deal. The change she went through was huge. From enviable career, amazing partner, and touted prestige, all the way to a hospital bed with drips, where she felt completely terrible. It was there, in her misery, that she first opened up to the possibility of relinquishing all of it, giving it all up. And she didn't even know at the time for what. Why did she think about doing such a reckless thing? Why did she actually do it? Because she started to listen, she says, she started to listen to the voice in her own heart. Here's her words. "I started listening to the voice I heard while sitting on my bed in the hospital. Basically, what I realized," she says, "is that every time something has not been right for me, I have known. I have always known. Every mistake I have ever made has been when I have ignored that inner voice. It's connected to something bigger than my own ego, or to that person who wants to fit in with what's accepted." Now, I have to say, I've had similar experiences. I think of the day when I realized that I was going to give up my life in Detroit, including work that I simply loved, for some totally unknown future in the ministry. Ariane's story really brought that memory back sharp to me. But I too, you see, listened to the call of an inner voice, bigger than my own ego, greater than what was acceptable to my family or my friends, or even to parts of myself. I was not in a hospital, but I did spend over a year of deep emotional turmoil. Eventually, my eyes streaming with tears while driving across my state in a snowstorm, I said yes to that voice telling me to risk it all. I trusted the voice. The very next day, I applied to Star King School for the Ministry out in California. And when I left Detroit, eventually a year later, I didn't know where I was going to live or how I was going to pay for it all. I just knew I had to listen to the voice and go. Now, when I say voice, I am pretty sure that most of you understand it as a figure of speech. Like when I or Rumi or any other poet use the word heart. I know I have a heart inside my chest, underneath this skin, made of muscle. So do you. But you know very well that when I speak of feeling something deep in my heart, I am not talking about that reliable pump, but my inner life. I hope you can use your same gifts with metaphor when you hear me using the word voice. Because I certainly hope that no one here will lump me or Ariane de Beauvoisin with those televised false prophets, Benny Hinn or Pat Robertson or Peter Popoff and so forth, who claim that they hear voices too, the voice of God speaking to them, giving them new revelations for me and for you to accept or else. The idea of someone claiming that God speaks to them is pretty much the same thing as someone claiming, or as I should say, as me claiming that I danced on the stage at Carnegie Hall. It's simply not true in the way I led you to take it, by me simply omitting relevant details. Whether or not there is a God of any description is not the issue here, mind you. The issue is whether a feeling that Pat Robertson has can be associated with something ultimate, however it's conceived. I think such assertions are not only dangerous, but I dare say mindlessly malevolent. But the inner voice or intuition I'm talking about has been celebrated by our Unitarian and Universalist ancestors for a long time, especially our Transcendentalist ancestors like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Henry David Thoreau, and Thomas Starr King. And the voice they celebrated is neither malevolent nor dangerous. I see it like they did, as a human gift central to the living of a principled deep life for many people, if not every person. I want to be clear that intuition, the inner voice, is not an idea that's going to resonate easily with everybody, since we're all unique and different in our ways of looking at our inner lives. But at the very least, the idea of the inner voice or intuition has long been a key notion bandied about in Unitarian Universalist conversation. Throughout his very famous essay, Self-Reliance, Waldo Emerson, an ordained Unitarian minister, asks us to trust not tradition, not conformity, but our own originality. He spoke of that unique inner voice as a vibration in our creative heart. We can only hear that voice when we allow ourselves to feel what we really honestly feel instead of what we're supposed to feel. But how do we decide whether the intuition, the inner voice, the honest feeling that we feel is something worth listening to. So worth listening to that we would take the risk, the real risk, of leaving a job that doesn't satisfy us, or leaving the familiar for the surprise that is not even yet knocking at the door. The children's story this morning gives us clues, certainly. The inner voice, which our story calls the cry of an owl, is heard in the woods only when you deliberately leave all the other noises of your life. The story calls them the singing of wild dogs or sad train whistles. It's best, the story suggests, to find a bit of silence if you want to hear something like your elusive inner voice. If you're in a crowded room, a clanging restaurant, or especially a way too busy, overcommitted life, believe me, you'll hear nothing except for noise. Then, the story says, you enter the woods where the owls actually live, the silent woods, the dark woods. This is a way of saying it's okay to admit that you're in the dark about a great deal. It's okay to admit that you don't have all the answers. Now, you have to be brave. Sure, the story insists. But the story also says that it's important to have someone who understands you nearby. The poet Rumi agrees. My heart, he says, spend time with those who understand you. In other words, you're not going to hear any inner voice if you spend all your time around people who don't understand you, who are critical of you, or who wish that you would be less like yourself and more like them. Rumi offers more advice. In the marketplace, don't wander about aimlessly. Find the shop with a potion that is sweet. In other words, be clear that your inner voice speaks what is sweet, that is wholesome, healthy, honest, and nourishing for your life. You have enough people in your life telling you you don't measure up or that you're lacking something. That's pretty bitter. Aim, says Rumi, for the supportive, for what's sweet. But, warns Rumi, be careful. If you don't have a way of measuring things, people will rob you. They'll steal from you in no time at all. And you will take counterfeit coins for real ones. In other words, just because you're paying attention to what you really feel deep down inside, don't toss your brain out the window. Just because you feel doesn't mean you don't have to think. You still need skills of discernment. You still need your capacity to distinguish your deep, supportive inner voice from all the other voices and the mere noise, and from your sour past voices that have been less than supportive, those voices that have also been echoing in your heart all these years. It's also helpful, said Rumi, if you're going to feel your feelings, to practice feeling them first. Practice trusting your feelings. He puts it this way. Not every joke is funny. So don't go looking for meaning when there isn't any. He's saying you don't need to laugh at a joke just to conform with everyone else who's laughing at it. It's okay if you don't get it, if you don't think it's funny, or if you think it's too crude and you don't like it. It's okay to say that. You don't have to conform. There's no shame in not knowing something, not getting everything, not liking something. There's no shame in asking questions. To practice trusting your feelings is simply to admit that you don't have all the answers already. And when you are listening to your inner voice, the call of the owl in the dark wood, try not to think of it as inevitable, magic, or worse, the voice of God. Not every ocean is full of pearls, Rumi says. Not every night forest houses owls, the story echoes. Don't flatter yourself by thinking that listening to your heart and deeper feelings will entitle you to some flashy final answer to all of life's questions. It won't. Sometimes your inner voice will not lead you to more fulfilling work, a more appropriate relationship, or anything quite so dramatic. Sometimes your insight won't be dazzling. Be clear about that. It's life, after all, not a magic show. My heart, says Rumi, sing your song of longing as if you were a night bird in the forest. And thus in the story, the father actually calls out, hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo, the sound of the owl, as if he were himself an owl. It's only when he expresses his longing that way that the night bird actually flies out from amongst the dark trees to make itself known. Rumi then says, the sound of your voice casts spells on everything around you, stones, even thorns. In other words, when you hearken to the voice, things may change for you. But you may also want to go further and actually deliberately change things around you, maybe even the thorns, maybe even especially the thorns, the sharp, painful places in life, social injustice, abject poverty, institutionalized cruelty, a foul example of which is the historical institution of slavery. And so I think of the Universalist minister Thomas Starr King, who was, as many of you know, the greatest abolitionist in California. Our seminary out there is named for him. It's the seminary Eric and I both attended. King was a small guy, no more than 5 feet tall. He weighed 120 pounds soaking wet. But he was fond of saying, when I get mad, I weigh a ton. Mad as a wet hen about slavery, he bravely went to logging camps and rough mining towns where he courageously preached to keep California in the Union and not divided by slavery. He and his stage coaches kept a travel schedule that would embarrass most of us, we with our airplanes and our cars and our Skype. But his travel plans was always in the service of keeping California united and just. The inner voice he trusted had brought him all the way from his beloved New England to California, back in the days when San Francisco was a pretty rough pioneer town. King missed Boston terribly all of the rest of his days. He never got used to the city on the bay. But once there, though, he preached twice every Sunday at the Unitarian Church, and he built up the membership from about 150 to 3,000, and he gave his all, in the meantime, to keeping California in the Union. His inner voice kept on calling to him once he was there. What did his voice sound like? I think I know. You see, when Starr King was a teenager, he met another teenager named Randolph Ryer back in New England. Even though once he moved to California, they never saw each other again. It was to Mr. Ryer that Starr King wrote his most personal, touching, and confessional letters, day in, day out. Ryer was his best friend, the person who really understood him, the one who gave him the sweet potions of real friendship and helped him to discern his deeper voice amidst the tinny noises of the world. Mr. Ryer was African-American. Starr King was Euro-American. Their friendship in those days was as rare can be, almost unheard of. And because this was the man who knew him best, I think that King's inner voice, the one that propelled him into hostile mining camps, must have sounded a lot like Ryer's voice. I think the voice said, "Work hard, my friend. Work hard to keep me in, not out. I am not a slave anymore, but many of my sisters and brothers are. Do everything you can to free us all." Listen, the inner voice doesn't come from God. It's not magic. It needs to be cultivated and shaped. And it has to be vetted like anything else worthy in our lives. It's not infallible. It won't help us to find pearls in the ocean if none are to be found there. But it has made all the difference in many lives, my own included. My friend Kim's voice only prompted me to dance on the stage of Carnegie Hall, and that was just for fun. Nothing wrong with that. But it was another voice, a voice deep inside me, cultivated by those who have loved me, tried to understand me, that called me past my own ego, past my need to fit in, and which sets my feet next to this pulpit every Sunday morning to speak of justice and peace and truthfulness, week after week, year after year. Today, I am thankful that I actually took the time one day to stop and listen to that voice.